Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 4th of September 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at RadioAlbion.com tonight, because we would normally have Dennis Wise with us tonight, but instead we have another special guest. Before I introduce him, I'll just give the listeners an update on Dennis. There does seem to have been some improvement. He's had a test and that has come back with positive results, but we have to wait for a second test so that we can see whether it's an anomaly or not. But he won't be here for next week. Maybe he'll be back before November and this important date when he sees a specialist. Maybe he won't, but I am very pleased to say that we do have a special guest with us tonight. Once again, we have the author of Scalp Dance, Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate, Bloody Dawn, The Darkest Dawn, Bleeding Kansas, and the book we will be discussing tonight, Hellstorm, Mr. Thomas Goodrich. Tom, how are you doing, sir? How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing fine, Sven. You sound like you're doing pretty good yourself.
Yeah, I'm okay. I've been enjoying these podcasts. I mean, I do miss Dennis, but I've found the information that you're bringing to us absolutely fascinating. I've always enjoyed listening to interviews with you before, and a lot of the time I've often thought I wish the host would just keep quiet and allow you to keep talking, because it's just such fascinating information.
Well, thank you so much. I don't normally feel that way when I'm on the other end of the interview. I feel like I'm very inadequate, and I feel like I'm always coming up short because whatever I say, it lacks a certain coherence, or it lacks the linear quality that a book has. You go from chapter to chapter and it follows some line, some thread. Whereas when I'm doing an interview, I get the questions and I have to go at them separately. And so everything probably seems very disjointed and to the listener. And I apologize for that, but there's no other way to do this, apparently. But anyway, I want to say this before we go any further. Yes, I also, Dennis is a good friend of mine. And I hope everything turns out okay. I got a feeling it will. He's a fighter, as we all know. And Dennis, if you're listening, hang in there, my friend. Better days are ahead for you. And in fact, I know a few things you don't that lead me to believe that the better days are ahead of you. So just get well, my friend.
Yes, and all our prayers are going out for Dennis at the moment. As I say, there does seem to have been some improvement. He seems to be in higher spirits this week when I've been speaking to him as well.
Good, well, good.
Let's get into Hellstorm again. I mean, you're saying there you think it's a bit disjointed. I think we've covered main subjects each week, and hopefully we'll finish with the subjects this week. I mean, we've covered the terror bombing. We've covered the starvation of prisoners after the war. We looked at the horrific mass rapes. Last week, we looked at the nautical disasters and the expulsion of the Germans from the East after the war. But you were telling me just before we went on air that there were also purges that went on, and I wasn't really aware of these. Do you want to begin by talking about those for a bit?
Yeah, I think many people already know about the French purges that occurred toward the end of the war when the Germans were driven out by the Allies after D-Day. The French, that is, mostly the French communists, decided this is a great time to take out our enemies, that is, the nationalist French. And they did a pretty good job of it. I think 100,000 Frenchmen died after the Germans were finally driven out by the Allies. The French communists turned upon these people. They accused them of collaboration, of course, and they accused them of being Nazis themselves. It's very similar to what's going on in Europe and America today. Some of the same characters were at work then as they are now. But most people don't know that Germany had been such a successful country throughout the centuries that other nations were envious and were happy to get Germans that were willing to come to their country. For instance, Hungary or Yugoslavia, Germans would come and increase the productivity in virtually everything they did, from farming to industry to research, just brought their culture with them, which was a confident, productive, energetic culture, and every nation wanted that. And so the Germans, throughout the centuries, by the millions, had went to other countries, not to escape Germany, nothing like that, just because there was more room, more opportunity to grow and to become what they always had intended to be. But at the end of the war, as soon as the Allies destroyed Germany and conquered every inch of it from the east and the west, at this time, other nations, the leaders, that is, decided, and generally they were socialistic type of leaders, and many of their people decided, well, let's take vengeance on these people that were so successful in our country that our other leaders, previous leaders, had invited them over. Now let's take some vengeance on them. So there was a lot of animosity because the Germans were so successful. One clear case, one that stands out, of course, and actually I devote a rather a semi-chapter to it in one of my chapters of the book, is the purge that occurred in Czechoslovakia at the end of the war. Apparently, the animosity there against Germans ran even deeper in Czechoslovakia than it did elsewhere, because what occurred there was an abomination, a horror, a crime so enormous that it, I was just baffled by it all when I was finally doing the research on this. In Prague, for instance, the Germans still occupied Prague because the Americans hadn't got there, neither had the Russians yet. And so the people themselves rose up. That is, the communists, the socialists, the people who have hated Germans had risen up and actually besieged the garrison in Prague. And this went on for several days, the fighting. Eventually, the Americans, though, were reported 6 miles away from Prague, and so the courage of the people themselves in Prague grew, and they actually took over the German fortress in Prague. And it was at this point that the awful atrocities began. There was no attempt, and in any of the niceties, no attempt to simply turn the Germans into POWs, that is the soldiers. And they were beaten on the way to the trucks that was to take them away to prison. They were stoned. They were beaten with iron bars, killed in the streets, shot, stabbed. This went on. Of course, there weren't any German soldiers left. They would hang them from the poles in the main square, Venceslav Square, in the middle of Prague. And apparently every light pole had a soldier, a German soldier, dangling from it, dead, of course, hung. But then they turned upon the people themselves. There were quite a few German refugees who had thought they could find some safe haven in Prague. Of course, they did not. This enormous mob of thousands turned against them also and did virtually the same things that they did to the soldiers, except in this case, they added torture and public humiliation to the picture. By that, I mean actually stripping young girls naked and forcing them to do various ugly things with one another, or as they were being abused and as they were being tortured. Terrible things. I don't need to get into this. I think the imagination of the listeners can fill in the blanks on this. But when they were through with them, when they were through with the amusement, that is the howling mobs, they would beat them, of course, with rocks and iron bars and logs and things like that. Or sometimes they would, for instance, mothers with children, 2 and 3 children, they would capture them. They would tie them up with barbed wire, tie them into a circle and tie them tightly so they couldn't get loose. Their children were still running around trying to get their mothers, but they would then, the children would be in, for instance, this one incident that occurred. The women were doused in gasoline and set a fire. And of course, it went up in a huge explosion. And the children had tried to seek cover in a in one of the grates, one of the sewer grates. And the gasoline, of course, got down there too. And the mothers actually were trying to get loose from the barbed wire, not so much to save their life, but to save their children. And they would actually be reaching down while they're still on fire, trying to bring their children out of these gutters. And of course, it didn't work. They all died. But this was huge public entertainment. People in mobs would watch this, laugh, cheer, dance. And then eventually they got several thousand more prisoners, civilians, mostly women, children, and took them to the local soccer field, the football stadium. And there they carried out some insanely demonic amusement for them, terrible things. One woman who was pregnant and she was knocked down and her belly was cut open. The child pulled out and a dachshund dog was stuck inside of her belly. And the people loved that. And they were various things. They were forced to get on the ground and crawl after one another like dogs, naked, of course, men, women, children. And they were then compelled to eat one another's excrement as they marched along. And these sadistic beasts who were in the stadium watching this as if it were some sort of Roman gladiator contest, they were euphoric in their cheers and shouts and joy of what they were seeing. You know, I have visited Czechoslovakia before, and I think, my God, some of the people I liked and enjoyed were with their mothers and fathers and grandfathers doing these very same things. And when you think like that, it's the world becomes a very, very different place, by the way. And so I more or less have to dismiss thoughts like that and accept people the way they are. And I tried to, and I did, I think, to a point. But this went on for days and days and even weeks, this attempt to purge all of Czechoslovakia of all Germans. Germans now had lost the war. They had no more protection. The German Wehrmacht, the German army, could no longer march in and save these people. And the Allies darn sure weren't going to do that. In fact, the Allies were probably encouraging this by not marching into Prague, which they could have done, the Russians and the Americans, anytime they wished to. But rather than stop this beastly, monstrous atrocities going on, they preferred to allow it. Now, that's just Czechoslovakia, and there's much, much more that I'm not putting in this.
Let me just interject there a minute. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. to say that, I mean, this is going on in Czechoslovakia. I can remember hearing in a podcast about similar going on in Romania and the prisons there, and they were forcing them to eat excrement and things like this. And it was the commissars, and it was the people that were involved in the KGB that were doing this. Now, was this just the townsfolk that were involved in this, or was it the communists that were sort of taking their revenge? Because you also hear about how when the Germans went in, they liberated places, especially in some of the Slavic countries, Croatia, Serbia, places like that, that there was an uprising of people as soon as the Germans came, and they wanted to get their own back on the communists, and they were pretty vicious against the communists. So was it the communists that were responsible for this, or was it just the general townsfolk that were also joining in?
My instinct tells me, yes, it was the communists. It was the Jewish commissars. It was the people like that who had an exceptionally strong hatred toward the Germans, because only that kind of hatred could explain some of these vicious, beyond belief, tortures that the Germans were that happened to the Germans. I don't have any accounts, however, of Jews or commissars instigating or egging on these crowds to do that. But you almost know this doesn't just happen. Things like this just don't happen. You and I, Sven, and 100 people listening could go out and start a mob, and I can almost guarantee you we'll never get this vicious unless we allow some particularly sadistic individual to suddenly guide us and tell us what to do, and let's do this, let's do that. And then you've got a mob drunk on blood and sadism. And I can see where some of the more unsettled, unstable people could enjoy it and actually get involved with it and maybe perhaps even ramp it all up a little bit. But all I can, the only thing I can say about this is that it seems there's no limit to the depravity, the bestiality of humans when they're in a certain mood, a certain state of hatred, of viciousness and violence. And having never gone through anything like this in my life, thank God, I can't, it's hard for me to relate to it. I can read what people wrote. In other words, everything that I'm saying now are things that I read, I researched, I found out in the words of the people themselves. In other words, I can't dispute that because they're saying these things. The reason some people might say, well, oh, you could get other accounts too that don't say the same thing. Well, I could, but if they were there. But everything I found about the purge of Germans from Czechoslovakia, everyone virtually backed up what the other person had said from independent sources too, by the way, not just a couple of people who happened to let's start a really terrible rumor about what happened to the Germans. No, on and on. It's one terrible account after another. And as far as the Jewish hand in this, of course, I'm sure there were one of the misconceptions that most people to this very day have about Jews in Europe at this time is that they're all in concentration camps. They're not. Many of them are still free, still running around. They're not in concentration camps. I think it was something, a number like 50,000 Jews were still free to do whatever they wanted in Berlin during the war.
A lot of them were involved in partisans.
Were not in concentration camps, and I'm assuming that goes for other German cities as well. So in other words, there are very many Jews who, yes, secretly, no doubt, in their heart of hearts, hated the Germans with a passion. And so these people, or the ones that were released from concentration camps that were in concentration camps during the war, came out, and certainly they had a lot of hate in their hearts because they perhaps had lost all of their property, all of their money. And not only that, but they'd spent the last couple of years in a concentration camp. And that would be no fun, no matter how well they were treated, no matter how much food they received. That would still be, it would be something that you would be resentful for, to put it mildly. And so there's a lot of people out there who do hate the Germans because, after all, let's face it, for the first several years, they were winning the war and they were a proud people and they were proud that they were winning the war, parade after parade with the march music. And so when it was finally official that the Germans had lost, then of course the pent up hatred of so many people came out. And what I described here in Czechoslovakia is, it perhaps was going on as bad or maybe even worse in other countries. I simply did not, you could write a book on that alone, but I stuck with what I had in my hand about Czechoslovakia and Prague, but perhaps, Romania, Hungary, even though they were allies, technically allies of the Germans. I know purges happened there, Yugoslavia,
another thing that makes me think of in Prague and in Czech, I mean, up into the Czech Republic, I'm guessing that's partly Czechoslovakia, and I know Prague, and that was treated very well for quite some time, and because it was treated so well, and because the guy that was in charge there was so well liked, there was a plot by the British to have him assassinated. So he was then assassinated, and then there was a response to that assassination from the Germans, which may have stirred the Prague people up. I forget the name of the guy who it was that they actually assassinated. He was very well known and very well liked German that was put in position there. Do you know the one I mean?
Oh, yes. And you're talking about Heydrich.
Yes, Reinhard Heydrich.
Yes. Yes, I don't mention that in the book, but I'm aware of the situation. The man who was running Czechoslovakia at the time was a guy named Edvard Beneš. And he was responsible, as responsible for the atrocities that occurred as any man living. At the time, he basically turned the Czech people loose on the Germans and encouraged them and said, basically, take everything they've got. Leave them only a sock to cry in. He was a very terrible man himself.
After they've been treated so well by the Germans, rebuilding the place and, you know, doing all that they could whilst they were occupied, they weren't trying to mistreat the people. I was just reading something else. I mean, this is somewhere else, but in Norway, where they were rebuilding Norway, and they had these glorious ideas of how Norway was going to look, and they'd got Halbert Speer in to do the architecture, and they were going to have railway systems up in the air, all sorts of things that they were going to do for the Norwegians. And I can imagine it was the same for the Czechs as well. It was not like this was a brutal occupation by the Germans. They were looking at improving the lives of the people whose countries they were occupying. They weren't looking at being brutal to them in any way. I mean, it's a horrific way to treat them after that.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, for an analogy, one need look no further than America right now and its black citizens who are turning viciously, violently on whites. Whites who for many, many decades have done their dead level best to improve the lot of blacks, to make life easier on them, quite honestly, to give them opportunities they never had before. And now we're going through this, which is very similar to what you're talking about now, Sven, about the Germans. Yes, the Germans had a rather benign approach to all the countries they occupied. There's no doubt about that. Even people who tell the truth in these countries will admit to that. But the propaganda was so terrible, so severe, and probably the consequences of actually standing up for the Germans after they'd been defeated and left, probably the consequences were pretty severe at the time because of who was running the country at the time. In other words, once the Allies won, they started installing or making sure their people were installed in various governments throughout Europe. And you could find yourself very quickly in a prison, I'm sure, if you did anything that showed the least sign of
just nationalism. I would guess that they put in people in place that were the complete opposite of nationalism, because they knew it was a nationalist. Alliance, wasn't it? So any hint of nationalism would have meant that you were under suspicion. They would have wanted people more like the communists that they were putting in power afterwards.
Well, yeah, in fact, that's still in place today, as we all know. That's why Europe is in such a situation right now. Yes, the fact is, Jews won World War II. There's no getting around that. They won World War II. Their main nations, of course, were Soviet Union, U.S. and Great Britain, U.K. And once that had been accomplished, that is the defeat of Germany and its allies, then it's an easy matter to basically start installing the people you want in every capital in Europe, because you're the strongest thing there is, and they cannot disagree with what you're saying, because they know what will happen to them, what happened to Germany. So to this very day, we still have the leftovers, the residue from World War II, that is the leadership in various countries right now, including, of course, and especially Germany, with the creatures they've got now running that country. But yes, that's the price of losing a major modern war. You don't just lose the war with the battle and the bullets and the bombs. You lose the history. You lose the truth of that entire war. All of it's been swept away, and the falsehood has taken its place, because that's what the victorious people want. And they got it, the Allies. They not only won the war, but they got the history. They own the history. To this very day, they own the history.
Well, can you tell us a bit about that, Thomas?
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that, the way that they took the history and the denazification and what went on afterwards to rid the Germans of their sense of identity and to turn them into the cowed people that they are today.
Mm-hmm. Denazification, yes, that occurred after the war. And as you can imagine, any German who had any ambition at all wanted to rise in whatever profession he was in. And the best way to do that, of course, would be join the Nazi Party, because it's like any government. Any successful government, you'll have people in line to join that particular government, that the politics of the government. And Germany was no different. People wanted to rise, and they also believed strongly in the system. Let's not forget that. Let's not just talk modern terminology here. Let's talk the way it really was back then. They loved their government. They loved the Nazi Party. It gave them everything in a handful of years. It took them from one of the most despised and impoverished nations in Europe to the richest and the most admired nation in the world. And so who wouldn't want to be a part of that? Join the Nazi Party and rise too, by the way, in your profession. And so at the end of the war, there was denazification. The Allies had just nearly lost the war and the world, by the way, to Nazi Germany. And now this is their time for revenge, basically. If you had a good job and you were a Nazi, you didn't have that good job for very long. Unless you were in a essential field, something that had to keep going. For instance, making bread. People are going to have some bread, that is the Allied soldiers who are living there, and some of the people, by the way. And so the denazification was basically, in theory, just throwing the Nazis out. What it really worked out to, though, is a lot more than that. It would have been enough for most people to simply displace the government you just defeated. Of course, get rid of them so that it doesn't happen again. You don't have to fight another war against them. But it went much, much further than that. In fact, denazification, there is a small chapter I do devote to that. And it comes down to something like this. If you were a Nazi, you could expect over the next year, and especially in the next weeks and months, knocks on the door. Late at night, preferably when you were in bed. And then you would have, let's just say this is in the American zone, you would have four or five U.S. GIs and an officer and a translator get out of the car, shake you out of bed, take you to jail. And this was part of the denazification approach itself. In theory, it was technically to question you, to find out what you knew, to unearth certain secrets that haven't been given up yet. But really, in practice, it was just a form of torture. It was something that the Allies could do, and they did do. The greatest example of this, I think, is probably Leni Riefenstahl, who was probably the greatest filmmaker in the world to that time. Leni Riefenstahl had made the movie Olympia about the Olympics, the 1936 Olympics in Germany, and Triumph of the Will, which was about the Nazi Party, its rise, its power, its prestige, its pride. Yes, overall, it's about its pride of taking Germany from nothing, that is a beggar nation after World War I, to the top of the world food chain, basically. That's what that movie was about. Leni made those movies. They're incredible. Even to this day, if you watch these movies and have an open mind too, by the way, just watch it for art's sake. Don't watch it because of the politics but Leni was doing things back then that it took modern filmmakers quite a while to get the knack of. She was doing things with such beauty and perfection and art. But Leni was not a Nazi, but she was a great filmmaker. She was a former actress, and she was a friend of Hitler, and that was the most inexcusable part of it for the Allies, that she was a friend of Hitler, and some people even said that they were lovers, which is not true. Leni was happily married, and Hitler, he already had his lady friend, his girlfriend, his woman he loved. I'm talking about Eva Braun, of course. But Leni, in fact, I start this chapter with the knock on the door, the soldiers and their flashlights and the rifles pointed at Leni and her husband, and she's forced to get dressed and then taken away at midnight, 1, 2, or 3 o'clock, whatever, and taken to the prison, the closest prison for Germans nearby. Well, this was Lenny's seventh arrest when I start. In other words, she had gone through this seven times prior to this. Here's a lady who was not a Nazi, although she was part of the denazification process, but it was someone that they could finally pay back for her success in Germany and for the love that the people shared for Leni. Leni was just, I don't know how to put it in modern terms, but think of someone you like and you admire as much as anybody in your nation right now. And then magnify that by 10 and you've got Leni Riefenstahl. But Leni underwent torture. First, she's thrown into a darkened jail cell with two other women. One is crazy. She's lost her mind and she's screaming and babbling. And the other is curled up on a bed and not moving. It's entirely dark in this. And Leni, this blue-blooded first-class lady, has to put up with this. And then she's, Leni's case, Leni didn't talk too much about it, like some of the people did talk about it. But Leni, the one instance I've got of her having to go through what it was she went through was she was told to go down and fall into line because Americans were interrogating Germans. I believe they were German soldiers in the courtyard outside. And so Leni was ordered to go down there and get in line with them. And she tried to be very military-like and tried to get in line straight. But as they were questioning these soldiers, and I assume this was an American Jew who was doing it because he could speak German, but he would ask them questions. The first one he came to, he asked the question, "Were you in the party? Were you in the Nazi party?" And the first man answered, "Yes." And the interrogator slugged him right in the mouth, knocked his teeth out. And then he went to the next guy in the next line. Lenny's describing this, by the way. Goes to the next line. "Were you in the party?" And he paused for a moment. Then he said, "Yes," just like the first. And again, he was slugged and blood just ran down his face. And the interrogator went to the next person in line and asked him, "Were you in the party?" And he thought for a second, and then he said, "No." And so the interrogator walked by him and didn't slug him in the face. But this is what Leni was going through. And this isn't the type of torture that comes with the other people who are going through denazification. Other people of less renown, they would, for instance, if it was a man, I'm thinking of this one couple who was taken in. And when I say they, and it sounds like there are very few, I'm talking about tens of thousands of people and maybe even millions of people, because let's face it, it's the Nazi party that their denazification plan is for. A couple who were taken in one night, and the wife was taken immediately into a nearby room with windows and raped by American soldiers. And other American soldiers were standing outside the window watching this as it was going on, while the man, oh, by the way, yes, this case was a German man and his Jewish wife. And so they were in raping the Jewish wife, while the man they were interrogating, their way of interrogating is basically asking the same questions. Were you in the party? Were you, were you eating popcorn some night? And then a slug in the face. And the husband's had his teeth knocked out. And the American soldiers who were helping in this so-called interrogation were laughing. And the German man said, "You're no gentleman." And, you know, that's something a German might say, but to an American, that's just laughable. And so they did. They laughed. He says, "No, we're not gentlemen. We're Mississippi boys." In other words, from a state here in the U.S., Mississippi. Rather rough state, by the way. But the interrogation, it could involve anything. And it generally did. Crushed testicles, because you didn't answer the right question. We're not talking about giving away great German secrets of where gold is hidden, things like that. We're talking about simple torture. Call it denazification, call it anything you want. It's torture to have things driven under your fingernails, to be burned with cigarettes, to have your testicles squished, to have your head hit so hard that over and over that it becomes double its size. This is the fun part of winning a war, apparently. This is the part that, well, this is what propaganda did to Germany. All the propaganda, all the hate-filled words said about the Germans and how low they are and all the terrible things they had been, according to the propaganda, been doing to Jews and other people. Now chickens coming home to roost. Now we can do anything we want, and we will do anything we want to these terrible, terrible, bloodthirsty Germans and their arrogance. But that's denazification. Don't look for it to be any more complicated than what I'm describing right now. Yes, I'm sure there were some people who were questioned about certain things in business and industry. And I'm sure some of the things they divulged was of a benefit to the Allies, especially the Americans. But on the other hand, the way the Americans, especially the Americans, went about it, that's as beastly and base and low as any humans can ever act.
I'm just wondering what were the secrets that they were after? I mean, they've got all the leadership of the National Socialists. They had all of them. They had them ready to go to Nuremberg. What on earth were they trying to find out from these people? What was their, what was the excuse?
So many times, the German comments I read were, we're nobodies. What kind of secrets could we possibly have? Why am I being kept here for weeks and weeks and being tortured to boot? I'm a farmer, for God's sakes, or I'm a corporal in the Wehrmacht. I didn't know any military secrets. I don't know where gold's buried. I don't know how to improve the range of artillery shells, things like that. There's nothing we can give them. And yet that when you read enough of that and you read about normal, common people, housewives, for God's sakes, that are going through this torture I'm describing, then you realize this is nothing but a sadistic entertainment for the winners. It gets even worse, of course, for instance, the so-called war crimes trials against the Germans. First, I've got to say this because it does sound like sometimes I'm an apologist, but I'm fairly sure that there were atrocities committed by the Germans at some point in the war. I simply don't know of them. Again, keep in mind, this book is not about what Germans did to the Allies. This is about what the Allies did to the Germans. If I had written a book that told both tales, it'd be three times its size. But on the other hand, I'm pretty certain, unless I used as source material a lot of the modern propaganda and lies that came out of World War II, that I would be doing nothing more than just passing on more of the same. And you can get them in 1,000 different books and hundreds of different movies. If you want the Allied version of World War II, that's where you go, the libraries or bookstores or movie theaters. What I wanted and what I still want is to know what it was like to lose that war. And the book, I think it does a fairly good job. People tell me it does, and so do the reviewers, that you can really appreciate what the Germans went through. And also, I can say things like this because, like I said, this book is not about what the Germans did to the other side. But even from many of the Allies, that is the honest ones, the generally, I was getting ready to say it's generally from just the rank and file soldiers, but no, there are generals who actually, it seems like they're standing up for the Germans because they're saying, look, I faced Germans 3 years. In North Africa, in Italy, in Eastern Europe, generals who might say this, American generals. And he said, I know there were some bad things going on, but I can't name one. In other words, on the German side, during the fighting. In fact, soldiers themselves, they would say, I'll tell you what, one British soldier said, say what you want about the Germans, but they took a lot better care of our dead than we did theirs. They gave us crosses. They put the helmets on the crosses. In other words, you read enough of this and you start seeing an entirely different picture of World War II. A picture that is still relevant today now, the Allies' version of World War II, because it's still understood and accepted by most of Europe and most of America and Canada and Australia. But
that's because of Nuremberg, isn't it? That's what they bring up is Nuremberg. Oh, there was a trial. They were found guilty. We had a trial, yeah, so that covers it all. Never mind, it was
quite
just
a trial, wasn't it, Sven? It was quite a trial. You know something about that,
yeah,
too.
Tell us about the trial. Tell us about the trial, Tom, the Nuremberg trial.
First of all, Nuremberg is the most famous and largest, but it wasn't the only one. There were trials all over Germany. War crimes trials. In other words, okay, we've won this war. Now let's set this up. This kangaroo court, this one-way court, and let's adjudicate it, and let's write about it so that the rest of the world can always have this. This is our opinion. First and foremost, I mean, you cannot go anywhere when you're talking about Nuremberg or any of the other war crime trials without starting with this. Virtually everybody was tortured on the German side. Virtually everybody suffered some form of sadistic torture. It just depends on who the torturer, what the torturer really wanted from these people. But beyond that, on and on, to sign incriminating documents that implicated major generals. I'm talking about the bigger officers that would implicate them in this. That was an easy thing to do because some who tried to refuse, you know, after you've been shocked with the electric wires all over your body and had your testicles smashed, flattened, no more use. And that's another way of sterilizing a German, by the way, which was one of the policies put forth by FDR and his Jewish Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, was the sterilization of all German men, but by squashing their testicles, that's, you're killing two birds with one stone, so to speak. You're torturing the guy, and he's never going to have any children after this. But yes, you go through this. There was one soldier who went through almost everything, but he refused to lie. Refused to implicate his superiors. And yet he, too, also ultimately gave in and had to sign. He just couldn't take anymore. He was dying quickly, and he was a young man. And finally, he had to sign this false document. But this is the standard. These are not exceptions. These are not anomalies in the procedure. These are the standards. The reason I know, because I've read as much as anybody on earth about the people who went through this, those who survived, that is, and hundreds didn't survive. I'm not talking now just about Nuremberg. These are the higher-ups in the Nazi government, the German government, Hermann Göring, people like that, Adolf Speer. If you notice, too, most of these people in Nuremberg, you just see their faces. You don't see their bodies. Their bodies are probably just littered with bruises and cut marks, things like this. But this is the war that was won by the Allies, and this is the war they called the Good War. And this is the war fought by what the Americans call the Greatest Generation. And I defy anybody with an open mind to read Hellstorm and then tell me those same things. Tell me that. Tell me this was a good war. Tell me this was the Greatest Generation. And then I'll give you a psychopath, somebody who can read this book or listen to this book. By the way, it's also in audio form. Or watch this book. It's also in DVD form. And then I'll give you a first-class psychopath, sociopath, you name it, whatever you want to call their sickness, someone who's gravely ill.
This is a thing, isn't it? People just don't know about this stuff. There's not enough information like this is out there. I mean, you've done us a great service writing this book, exposing this stuff, all these confessions, none of them can be relied upon because they were all tortured. They weren't allowed to bring in any of their own defense papers. They were only allowed to use the defense that they were given. The people that were brought in to defend them were told that they're not allowed to actually defend them. And it was a tribunal. It wasn't even a proper trial. It was a tribunal, and the outcome of it was already decided. You had Jewish interpreters, Jewish interrogators, loads of Jews that were actually in the court itself, and yet the accusation were that they had been mistreating the Jews, that they had been gassing the Jews. So you had the supposed victim that was involved in all of the prosecution, rather than there being an impartial prosecution. And you had the three people that had won the fight, essentially, standing in judgment. Yeah, you had the Allies standing in judgment when they were the other side of the fight, basically. And it turned everything on end. All principles of justice, law, and honor that we had had up until this point. And I think it really set a precedent since then, because the courts and justice has never recovered from that, from that being held up, because it is held up as, you know, this is the principle now. Now we can go after anybody else. We can go after Saddam Hussein. We can go into Serbia. We're going to hold Milosevic up there in a court. We can hold these international courts and tribunals. And then after the fact, we can justify it all and say that this was a just war. And never before had anything like that happened. If you lost the war, you lost the war. You didn't get humiliated in a court and told that you'd done wrong, because they were defending their lives. What are they supposed to do? Just accept it. Just not defend themselves. I mean, that's the whole point in a war, isn't it? You got one side fighting against the other side. And what they're saying here is they shouldn't have defended themselves. They should have just allowed them to come in and given an unconditional surrender at the beginning. Essentially, it seems to me.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything you've said. In fact, yes, they can do this after the war. They can try their enemy as if it were an open and free trial, and then they're guaranteed of the media monopoly, the Jewish monopoly on the media, of backing up everything they say and convincing that it's gullible stooges at home, the Americans, the British, that these were fair, honest, decent trials. Look, see all the people in black, see all the people asking questions, see all the people that are helping the prosecutors come to an arbitrary conclusion that's fair, honest. And yes, they did convince almost all of our people, let's face it. It's easier to read something and accept it and think about it, to think about whether this is true or not. And you're right. World War II has, well, we look around us right now, and this is the residue. This is the results of World War II, exactly. Everything about it I've got some choice words. I'm glad we're on the air, or I'd be using choice words right now, because, yeah, I'm like anybody else. I cannot stand the falsehoods, the terrible things that were done and said to this very day against the Germans. Projections, mostly. Americans were great at projecting their crimes onto the Germans, and there was nothing the Germans could do, of course. There was... Not only had Germans lost the war and surrendered their armies, but they gave up their any hope for the truth, because now the other side owns the publishing presses. They own the newspapers. They own the only way that other people can learn about it. And it's still continuing to this very day.
It's the injustice of it all, isn't it? Just the it's the injustice of it all. The injustice.
It is. If you're European, it's in our DNA. We spent so many centuries among one another that we developed our own morality, our own ethics, and we trusted one another. We had to. We had to survive the winters, and so we've developed this body of beliefs among one another, and we accepted that it was. Lying is like, it's only for children. And even then, children soon learn that there are bigger problems down the line if you lie. And so they learn to stop lying. But it didn't work in World War II because the other side had control now and they could do all they wanted. And so that's probably why Germany itself was so easily convinced about the so-called Holocaust, the treatment of other people, how terrible the German war machine was in Russia, treating the people, because they had always believed the newspapers and the books, because they would, for the most part, been honest back before they were controlled by the side that won. So that's probably still a big problem. I've often thought about that too. And to free ourselves today, yeah, it would help if we had a whole lot more of the enemy in us. On the other hand, I don't want to be a part of the enemy. No, I want to be what I am, what I was meant to be. I don't know of any other way except the truth to fight the enemy. To adopt some of the enemy's tactics is to make us no better than the enemy.
Yeah, it just turns us into the enemy. You know, we have to be the honorable ones here. Have you had any contact from Germans about the book or the video? Are they available in Germany? Because I can't see that it breaks any of the German laws.
Well, apparently it's breaking some laws, because somewhere you can get it, somewhere you can't. The book, the movie, the video, the audio book too. Those Germans, like I said, I'd lived for a while in exile in Germany, and so I did get around a bit, and I talked to some people, and I had learned that even though it's a small book, as books go, as good selling books go, it's a small book, but it has been translated into German. And it's been that way for, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 years now. And enough people have read it, and enough people have told other people about it, that I think it is having some really positive impact upon young Germans, younger Germans today. I've heard people say that. And I'm not going to go too much on this. It's still a very small book, as books go. But I have to tell you this, and I think it's, you can understand as soon as I say this, that the book has had great impact upon the English-speaking world. Those who have read it, it's caused a lot of turmoil. It's caused lots of people who basically, they just simply cannot believe it. And yet they do believe it, because it's annotated, it's got the notes, it's got the sources that I use, the people's voices themselves. But if you're a German, you can well imagine the impact upon, let's say, a 25-year-old German who just went through a Marxist college in Germany, was indoctrinated, and then suddenly, some night, he's picked up Hellstorm and begins to read this, and checks on the sources to see where they're coming from. Is the author making this up, or can this possibly be true? All the things he's heard and been told about what his grandfather and his father may have done during the war, it suddenly stops sounding like truth to him. And the more he reads, the more he realizes this is the truth. This is what really happened. I mean, he really gets to understand that. And then you've got a very powerful force on your hands. You've got somebody who now understands the duplicity of the world around him, the treachery, the lies, the hatred that surrounds his nation, his town, his family. And then you've got a very angry person, sad, yes, but angry also. Now, I know that's the case because I've talked to enough people about this.
I should imagine that it really is, you know, it's more important for the British readers and the English language to understand, because, you know, we were the ones that did this. It was our people that did this. So it's important that we learn this and make sure it doesn't happen again. And we speak out about the truth of this. And, you know, we show the regret for being a part of it, because we were a part of it. It was our leaders that went and did this. I mean, we can criticize the Jews as well. They were involved, but it was still Britain, America and the Soviet Union that were standing there in Nuremberg, and it was still our soldiers that fought against them. We fell for the Jewish propaganda, but it was still us that fell for it. Jews are only a tiny little minority. You know,
you're making a very good point, Sven. It's important to find out. as far as the leadership of this war, it was Jewish, top to bottom, basically. Yes, these are the ones that put out the propaganda. But if you really want to know who's at fault in this war, just go look in the mirror. It's us who so willingly fell into line behind these people to kill our own brothers and sisters. You're right. You know, there's a common saying here in America. It was said by many people. I remember hearing it growing up, and I'm sure it was in the UK as well, about Uncle Fred or Uncle Charlie or Uncle Bill who fought in the war in Europe. And when they finally got home and the family wanted to hear more about his exploits in the war, they were surprised. Uncle Bill, Uncle Fred, Uncle Bob didn't want to talk about it. Didn't want to talk about it at all. And they could never understand that because after all, they were the greatest generation who won the good war. Shouldn't they be proud? Shouldn't they be happy? Shouldn't they share it all with us? Because we want to hear it. Well, now I know why Uncle Bill, Bob, Fred didn't talk about that war, because probably they actually did some of the terrible things that they saw. They saw terrible things, but they may have actually done some of those terrible things, like murder of helpless, defenseless POWs, people with no guns, no weapons, murder, raping women, farm women, daughters, little girls, one after another, raping them as they go along and laughing about it, because everybody else is doing this very same thing, and they're paying back this terrible race, the Germans, for all the things, bad things they had done that we've been told they did. And so that's probably why Uncle Fred, Bill, Bob, Jim, whatever his name was, didn't want to talk at all about the war in America. And that was just that was common coinage back then, too.
No, I think it's the same in Britain.
I'm assuming UK was very similar to that, too.
Yeah, well, I can remember both my grandfathers didn't want to talk about it. And I don't think they would have been involved in this, but they wouldn't talk about it. It wasn't like a glorious thing. You know, we got the dirty Hun or anything like that. Yeah, they didn't want to talk about it at all. So, I mean, from my own experience, asking like both my grandfathers about it, they didn't want to talk about it. So that's very true.
And probably much the same could be said about pilots. I would hope so, because the ones who dropped the bombs, the fire bombs on defenseless German cities, killing thousands, hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children, but mostly old people and women and children, or the pilots who shot up anything that moved in Germany, the targets of opportunity, murder spree. Hopefully they grew up and not only grew up physically, but morally, mentally, and one day realized the terrible things they had done. Perhaps pledged themselves that they would never allow that to happen again in their time. Now, I don't know so much about that, except otherwise there's no hope for any of us.
No, I think the British people did after the war. As soon as they got the chance, they voted Winston Churchill out of office. And when he was during the war, he suspended the electoral process, so nobody could vote. We had no democracy during the war, and as soon as democracy was reinstated, he was kicked out of office. Nobody voted for him, and he should have, you know, he should have won by a landslide. He just won a world war, and yet he was kicked out of office. He was really not wanted by the people. They didn't want to go to war. They were forced to go to war. It wasn't seen as a glorious victory. The end of the war was seen as great. At last, the war has ended. But the celebrations weren't, we have defeated the enemy, we're the top dog. It was the celebrations was because the war has finally ended. That was the reason for it. And I think and then after that, the propaganda didn't stop. The propaganda continued. With the Nuremberg trials and continually since then with the movies, with the Holocaust trademark and all of that. And it's kept getting worse and worse. And the people that do remember it and how terrible it was, you know, they've died out. The ones that knew that the war never should have happened and we were forced into it and nobody wanted to go to war. Even that side of it is now gone. You know, it's presented as bringing freedom and democracy to the world. And we had to do it. We had to go after evil Hitler, who wanted to build a world empire. Never mind the fact we had the British Empire. Germany just had Germany. I don't think they even had any African colonies. And that's why they were talking about going to Russia. Well, I hope we've really covered everything in Hellstorm thoroughly. Of course, we can't do all of it justice, but I'm hoping you'll come back next week to discuss Hellstorm 2 Thomas, and have a look at Japan. But we've just about finished tonight's podcast. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.